The wind was constant. They would move. Over a period of decades and centuries, they would, well, would walk. Wasn't that what they called dunes on a beach? Walking dunes? He seemed to remember that from his childhood, or school, or someplace. And what in the hell did it matter? Now he saw a delicate rill of sand slip down the flank of one of them, as if it heard what I was thinking. Fresh sweat on the back of his neck. All right, he was getting a touch of the whim-whamps. Who wouldn't? This was a tight place they were in, very tight, and Rand seemed not to know it, or not to care. It had some sand in it, and the warbler was cracked, but there must have been 60 of those in Grimes's odds and ends box. Is he even hearing me? I don't know how the sand got in it. It was right where it was supposed to be, in the storage compartment behind the bunk. 3 closed hatches between it and the outside, but... Oh, sand spreads. Gets into everything. Remember going to the beach when you were a kid, Bill? You'd come home and your mother would yell at you because there was sand everywhere. Sand in the couch, sand on the kitchen table, sand down the foot of your bed. Beach sand is very... He gestured vaguely, and then that dreamy, unsettling smile resurfaced. Ubiquitous. But it didn't hurt it any, Shapiro continued. The emergency power output system is ticking over, and I plugged the beacon into it. I put on the earphones for a minute and asked for an equivalency reading at 50 parsecs. Sounds like a power saw. It's better than we could have hoped. No one's going to come. Not even the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys have all been dead for 8,000 years. Welcome to Surf City, Bill. Surf City sans surf. Shapiro stared out at the dunes. He wondered how long the sand had been here. A trillion years? A quintillion? Had there been life here once? Maybe even something with intelligence? Rivers? Green places? Oceans to make it a real beach instead of a desert? Shapiro stood next to Rand and thought about it. The steady wind ruffled his hair, and quite suddenly he was sure all those things had been, and he could picture how they must have ended. The slow retreat of the cities as their waterways and outlying areas were first speckled, then dusted, finally drifted and choked by the creeping sand. He could see the shiny brown alluvial fans of mud, sleek as sealskins at first, but growing duller and duller in color as they spread further and further out from the mouths of the rivers, out and out until they met each other. He could see sleek sealskin mud becoming reed-infested swamp, then gray, gritty till, finally shifting white sand. He could see mountains shortening like sharpened pencils, their snow melting as the rising sand brought warm thermal updrafts against them. He could see the last few crags pointing at the sky like the fingertips of men buried alive. He could see them covered and immediately forgotten by the profoundly idiotic dunes. What had Rand called them? Ubiquitous. If you just had a vision, Billy boy, it was a pretty goddamn dreadful one. Oh, but no, it wasn't. It wasn't dreadful. It was peaceful. It was as quiet as a nap on a Sunday afternoon. What was more peaceful than the beach? He shook these thoughts away. It helped to look back toward the ship. There isn't going to be any cavalry, Rand said. The sand will cover us, and after a while we'll be the sand, and the sand will be us. Surf City with no surf. Can you catch that wave, Bill? And Shapiro was scared because he could catch it. You couldn't see all those dunes without getting it. Fucking dronehead asshole, he said. He went back to the ship and hid from the beach. Sunset finally came, the time when, at the beach, any real beach, you were supposed to put away the volleyball and put on your sweats and get out the weenies and the beer. Not time to start necking yet, but almost. Time to look forward to the necking. Weenies and beer had not been a part of ASN 29 stores. Shapiro spent the afternoon carefully bottling all of the ship's water. He used a portavac to suck up that which had run out of the ruptured veins in the ship's supply system and puddled on the floor. He got the small bit left in the bottom of the shattered hydraulic system's water tank. He did not overlook even the small cylinder in the guts of the air purification system, which circulated air in the storage areas. Finally, he went into Grimes's cabin. Grimes had kept goldfish in a circular tank constructed especially for weightless conditions. The tank was built of impact-resistant clear polymer plastic and had survived the crash easily. The goldfish, like their owner, had not been impact-resistant. They floated in a dull orange clump at the top of the ball, which had come to rest under Grimes's bunk, along with three pairs of very dirty underwear and half a dozen porno holograph cubes. He held the globe aquarium for a moment, looking fixedly into it. "Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well," he said suddenly, and laughed a screaming, distracted laugh. Then he got the net Grimes kept in his lock bin and dipped it into the tank. He removed the fish and then wondered what to do with them. After a moment, he took them to Grimes's bed and raised his pillow. There was sand underneath. He put the fish there regardless, then carefully poured the water into the jerry can he was using as a catcher. It would all have to be purified, but even if the purifiers hadn't been working, he thought that in another couple of days he wouldn't balk at drinking aquarium water just because it might have a few loose scales and a little goldfish shit in it. He purified the water, divided it, and took Rand's share back up the side of the dune. Rand was right where he had been, as if he had never moved. "Rand, I brought you your share of the water." He unzipped the pouch on the front of Rand's EP suit and slipped the flat plastic flask inside. He was about to press the zip strip closed with his thumbnail when Rand brushed his hand away. He took the flask out. Stenciled on the front was ASN Class Ship Supplies Storage Flask CL number 2319675, sterile when seal is unbroken. The seal was broken now, of course. Shapiro had had to fill the bottle up. "I purified," Rand opened his fingers. The flask fell into the sand with a soft plop.
"Don't want it."
"Don't. Rand, what's wrong with you? Jesus Christ, will you stop it?"
Rand did not reply. Shapiro bent over and picked up storage flask number 2319675. He brushed off the grains of sand clinging to the sides as if they were huge, swollen germs.
"What's wrong with you?" Shapiro repeated. "Is it shock? Do you think that's what it is? Because I can give you a pill or a shot. But it's getting to me. I don't mind telling you. You just standing out here looking at the next 40 miles of nothing. It's sand. Just sand."
"It's a beach," Rand said dreamily. "Want to make a sandcastle?"
"Okay, good," Shapiro said. "I'm going to get a needle and an amp of Yellow Jack. If you want to act like a goddamn drone head, I'll treat you like one."
"If you try to inject me with something, you better be quiet when you sneak up behind me," Rand said mildly. "Otherwise, I'll break your arm."
He could do it, too. Shapiro, the astrogator, weighed 140 pounds and stood 5'5". Physical combat was not his specialty. He grunted an oath and turned away back to the ship, holding Rand's flask.
"I think it's alive," Rand said. "I'm actually pretty sure of it."
Shapiro looked back at him and then out at the dunes. The sunset had given them a gold filigree at their smooth, sweeping caps, a filigree that shaded delicately down to the blackest ebony in the troughs. On the next dune, ebony shaded back to gold, gold to black, black to gold, gold to black, and black to gold, and gold to... Shapiro blinked his eyes rapidly and rubbed a hand over them.
"I have several times felt this particular dune move under my feet," Rand told Shapiro. "It moves very gracefully. It is like feeling the tide. I can smell its smell on the air, and the smell is like salt."
"You're crazy," Shapiro said.
He was so terrified that he felt as if his brains had turned to glass. Rand did not reply. Rand's eyes searched the dunes, which went from gold to black to gold to black in the sunset. Shapiro went back to the ship. Rand stayed on the dune all night and all the next day. Shapiro looked out and saw him.
Rand had taken off his EP suit, and the sand had almost covered it. Only one sleeve stuck out, forlorn and supplicating. The sand above and below it reminded Shapiro of a pair of lips, sucking with a toothless greed at a tender morsel. Shapiro felt a crazy desire to pelt up the side of the dune and rescue Rand's EP suit. He did not. He sat in his cabin and waited for the rescue ship. The smell of Freon had dissipated. It was replaced by the even less desirable smell of Grimes decaying. The rescue ship did not come that day or that night or on the third day. Sand somehow appeared in Shapiro's cabin, although the hatchway was closed and the seal still appeared perfectly tight. He sucked the little puddles of sand up with the portivac as he had sucked up puddles of spilled water on that first day. He was very thirsty all the time. His flask was nearly empty already. He thought he had begun to smell salt on the air. In his sleep, he heard the sound of gulls, and he could hear the sand. The steady wind was moving the first dune closer to the ship. His cabin was still okay, thanks to the portivac, but the sand was already taking over the rest. Many dunes had reached through the blown locks and laid hold of ASN 29. It sifted in tendrils and membranes through the vents. There was a drift in one of the blown tanks. Shapiro's face grew gaunt and pebbly with beard shadow. Near sunset of the third day, he climbed up the dune to check on Rand. He thought about taking a hypodermic, then rejected it. It was a lot more than shock. He knew that now. Rand was insane. It would be best if he died quickly, and it looked as if that was exactly what was going to happen. Shapiro was gaunt. Rand was emaciated. His body was a scrawny stick. His legs, formerly rich and thick with iron pumper's muscle, were now slack and droopy. The skin hung on them like loose socks that keep falling down. He was wearing only his undershorts, and they were red nylon, and they looked absurdly like a ball-hugger bathing suit. A light beard had begun to grow on his face, fuzzing his hollow cheeks and chin. His beard was the color of beach sand. His hair, formerly a listless brown shade, had bleached out to a near blonde. It hung over his forehead. Only his eyes, peering through the fringe of his hair with bright blue intensity, still lived fully. They studied the beach. The dunes, goddammit, the dunes. Relentlessly. Now Shapiro saw a bad thing. It was a very bad thing indeed. He saw that Rand's face was turning into a sand dune. His beard and his hair were choking his skin. "You," Shapiro said, "are going to die. If you don't come down to the ship and drink, you are going to die." Rand said nothing. "Is that what you want?" Nothing. There was the vacuous snuffle of the wind, but no more. Shapiro observed that the creases of Rand's neck were filling up with sand. "The only thing I want," Rand said in a faint, faraway voice like the wind, "is my Beach Boys tapes. They're in my cabin."
"Fuck you," Shapiro said furiously. "But do you know what I hope? I hope a ship comes before you die. I want to see you holler and scream when they pull you away from your precious goddamn beach. I want to see what happens then."
"Beach'll get you too," Rand said. His voice was empty and rattling like wind inside a split gourd, a gourd which had been left in a field at the end of October's last harvest. "Take a listen, Bill. Listen to the wave." Rand cocked his head. His mouth, half open, revealed his tongue. It was as shriveled as a dry sponge. Shapiro heard something. He heard the dunes. They sang songs of Sunday afternoon at the beach, naps on the beach with no dreams, long naps, mindless peace, the sound of crying gulls, shifting, thoughtless particles, walking dunes. He heard and was drawn toward the dunes. "You hear it," Rand said.
Shapiro reached into his nose and dug with two fingers until it bled. Then he could close his eyes. His thoughts came slowly and clumsily together. His heart was racing. I was almost like Rand. Jesus, it almost had me. He opened his eyes again and saw that Rand had become a conch shell on a long deserted beach, straining forward toward all the mysteries of an undead sea, staring out at the dunes and the dunes and the dunes. No more, Shapiro moaned inside himself.
Oh, but listen to this wave, the dunes whispered back.
Against his better judgment, Shapiro listened. Then his better judgment ceased to exist. Shapiro thought, I could hear better if I sat down. He sat down at Rand's feet and put his heels on his thighs like a Yaqui Indian and listened. He heard the Beach Boys, and the Beach Boys were singing about fun, fun, fun. He heard them singing that the girls on the beach were all within reach. He heard a hollow sighing of the wind, not in his ear, but in the canyon between right brain and left brain. He heard that sighing somewhere in the blackness which is spanned only by the suspension bridge of the corpus callosum, which connects conscious thought to the infinite. He felt no hunger, no thirst, no heat, no fear. He heard only the voice in the emptiness. And a ship came. It came swooping out of the sky, afterburners scratching a long orange track from right to left. Thunder belted the delta wave topography, and several dunes collapsed like bullet path brain damage. The thunder ripped Billy Shapiro's head open, and for a moment he was torn both ways, ripped, torn down the middle. Then he was up on his feet. Ship! He screamed. Holy fuck! Ship! 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 It was a belt trader, dirty and buggered by 500 or 5,000 years of clan service. It surfed through the air, banged crudely upright, skidded. The captain blew jets and fused sand into black glass. Shapiro cheered the wound. Rand looked around like a man awaking from a deep dream.
Tell it to go away, Billy.
You don't understand. Shapiro was shambling around, shaking his fists in the air. You'll be all right. He broke toward the dirty trader in big leaping strides, like a kangaroo running from a ground fire. The sand clutched at him. Shapiro kicked it away. Fuck you, sand. I got a honey back in Hansonville. Sand never had no honey. Beach never had no hard on. The trader's hull split. A gangplank popped out like a tongue. A man strode down it behind three sampler androids, and a guy built into treads that was surely the captain. He wore a beret with a clan symbol on it anyway. One of the androids waved a sampler wand at him. Shapiro batted it away. He fell on his knees in front of the captain and embraced the treads which had replaced the captain's dead legs. The dunes. Rand. No water. Alive. Hypnotized him. Drone head world. I thank God. A steel tentacle whipped around Shapiro and yanked him away on his gut. Dry sand whispered underneath him like laughter.
It's okay. The captain said, Bat shell, me, gat.
The android dropped Shapiro and backed away, clittering distractedly to itself.
All this way for a fucking fed, the captain exclaimed bitterly.
Shapiro wept. It hurt not just in his head, but in his liver.
Dud, giat, gat, water for him cry.
The man who had been in the lead tossed him a nippled low-grav bottle. Shapiro upended it and sucked greedily, spilling crystal-cold water into his mouth, down his chin, in dribbles that darkened his tunic, which had bleached to the color of bone. He choked, vomited, then drank again. Dud and the captain watched him closely. The androids clittered. At last, Shapiro wiped his mouth and sat up. He felt both sick and well.
You Shapiro?
The captain asked. Shapiro nodded.
Clan affiliation? None. ASN number?
29.
Crew?
3. One dead. The other, Rand, up there.
He pointed but did not look. The captain's face did not change. Dud's face did.
The beach got him, Shapiro said.
He saw their questioning, veiled looks.
Shock, maybe. He seems hypnotized. He keeps talking about the beach boys.
Never mind, you wouldn't know.
He wouldn't drink or eat. He's bad off.
Dud, take one of the Andes and get him down from there.
He shook his head.
Fed ship, Christ. No salvage.
Dud nodded. A few moments later, he was scrambling up the side of the dune with one of the Andes. The Andy looked like a 20-year-old surfer who might make dope money on the side servicing bored widows, but his stride gave him away even more than the segmented tentacles which grew from his armpits. The stride, common to all androids, was the slow, reflective, almost painful stride of an aging English butler with hemorrhoids. There was a buzz from the captain's dashboard.
I'm here.
This is Gomez, Cap. We got a situation here. Comp scan and surface telemetry show us a very unstable surface. There's no bedrock that we can targ. We're resting on our own burn, and right now, that may be the hardest thing on the whole planet. Trouble is, the burn itself is starting to settle.
Recommendation?
We ought to get out.
When?
5 minutes ago.
You're a laugh riot, Gomez.
The captain punched a button and the communicator went out. Shapiro's eyes were rolling.
Look, never mind Rand. He's had it.
I'm taking you both back, the captain said. I got no salvage, but the Federation ought to pay something for the two of you. Not that either of you are worth much as far as I can see. He's crazy, and you're chicken shit.
No, you don't understand. You...
The captain's cunning yellow eyes gleamed.
You got any contra? He asked.
Captain, look, please.
Because if you do, there's no sense just leaving it here. Tell me what it is and where it is. I'll split 70-30. Standard salver's fee. Couldn't do any better than that, eh?
You...
The burn suddenly tilted beneath them. Quite noticeably tilted. A horn somewhere inside the trader began to blat with muffled regularity. The communicator on the captain's dashboard went off again.
There! Shapiro screamed. There, do you see what you're up against? You want to talk about contraband now? We have to get the fuck out of here!
Shut up, handsome, or I'll have one of these guys sedate you, the captain said.
His voice was serene, but his eyes had changed. He thumbed the communicator.
Cap, I got 10 degrees of tilt and we're getting more. The elevator's going down, but it's going on an angle. We've still got time, but not much. The ship's going to fall over.
The struts will hold her.
No, sir. Begging the captain's pardon, they won't.
Start firing sequences, Gomez.
Thank you, sir.
The relief in Gomez's voice was unmistakable. Dud and the android were coming back down the flank of the dune. Rand wasn't with them. The Andy fell further and further behind, and now a strange thing happened. The Andy fell over on its face. The captain frowned. It did not fall as an Andy is supposed to fall, which is to say, like a human being, more or less. It was as if someone had pushed over a mannequin in a department store. It fell over like that. Thump, and a little tan cloud of sand puffed up from around it. Dud went back and knelt by it. The Andy's legs were still moving as if it dreamed in the 1.5 million freon-cooled microcircuits that made up its mind, that it still walked. But the leg movements were slow and cracking. They stopped. Smoke began to come out of its pores, and its tentacles shivered in the sand. It was gruesomely like watching a human die. A deep grinding came from inside it.
Grrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr
Beach Boys religion.
The captain glanced at him impatiently.
Don't be ridiculous, man. The thing could walk through a sandstorm and not get a grain inside it.
Not on this world. The burn settled again. The trader was now clearly canted. There was a low groan as the struts took more weight.
Leave it, the captain bawled at Dud.
Leave it, leave it! Giat, come me for cry!
Dud came, leaving the Andy to walk face down in the sand.
What a balls up, the captain muttered.
He and Dud engaged in a conversation spoken entirely in a rapid pidgin dialect, which Shapiro was able to follow to some degree. Dud told the captain that Rand had refused to come. The Andy had tried to grab Rand, but with no force. Even then it was moving jerkily, and strange grating sounds were coming from inside it. Also, it had begun to recite a combination of galactic strip mining coordinates and a catalog of the captain's folk music tapes. Dud himself had then closed with Rand. They had struggled briefly. The captain told Dud that if Dud had allowed a man who had been standing 3 days in the hot sun to get the better of him, that maybe he ought to get another first. Dud's face darkened with embarrassment, but his grave, concerned look never faltered. He slowly turned his head, revealing 4 deep furrows in his cheek. They were welling slowly.
Him got big index, Dud said. Strong for cry. Him got for Umbi.
Umbi him for cry? The captain was looking at Dud sternly. Dud nodded.
Umbi, biat shell. Umbi for cry.
Shapiro had been frowning, conning his tired, frightened mind for that word. Now it came. Umbi. It meant crazy. He's strong, for Christ's sake. Strong because he's crazy. He's got big ways, big force, because he's crazy. Big ways. Or maybe it meant big waves. He wasn't sure. Either way, it came to the same. Umbi. The ground shifted underneath them again, and sand blew across Shapiro's boots. From behind them came the hollow ka-thud, ka-thud, ka-thud of the breather tubes opening. Shapiro thought it was one of the most lovely sounds he had ever heard in his life. The captain sat deep in thought, a weird centaur whose lower half was treads and plates instead of horse. Then he looked up and thumbed the communicator.
Gomez, send excellent Montoya down here with a tranquilizer gun.
Acknowledged.
The captain looked at Shapiro.
Now, on top of everything else, I've lost an android worth your salary for the next 10 years. I'm pissed off. I mean to have your buddy.
Captain? Shapiro could not help licking his lips. He knew this was a very ill-chosen thing to do. He did not want to appear mad, hysterical, or craven, and the captain had apparently decided he was all three. Licking his lips like that would only add to the impression, but he simply couldn't help himself.
Captain, I cannot impress on you too strongly the need to get off this world as soon as possible.
Can it, dronehead?
The captain said, not unkindly. A thin scream rose from the top of the nearest dune.
Don't touch me! Don't come near me! Leave me alone! All of you!
Big and Dick's got Umbi,
Dud said gravely.
Mahim, Yamon,
the captain returned, and then turned to Shapiro.
He really is bad off, isn't he?
Shapiro shuddered.
You don't know. You just...
The burn settled again. The struts were groaning louder than ever. The communicator crackled. Gomez's voice was thin, a little unsteady.
We have got to get out of here right now, Cap.
All right.
A brown man appeared on the gangway. He held a long pistol in one gloved hand. The captain pointed at Rand.
My hymn for cry, can?
Excellent Montoya, unperturbed by the tilting earth that was not earth but only sand, fused to glass, and there were deep cracks running through it now, Shapiro saw. Unbothered by the groaning struts or the eerie sight of an android that now appeared to be digging its own grave with its feet, studied Rand's thin figure for a moment.
Can,
he said.
Gat, gat for cry.
The captain spat to one side.
Shoot his pecker off, I don't care, he said, just as long as he's still breathing when we ship.
Excellent Montoya raised the pistol. The gesture was apparently 2/3 casual and 1/3 careless, but Shapiro, even in his state of near panic, noted the way Montoya's head tilted to one side as he lined the barrel up, Like many in the clans, the gun would be nearly a part of him, like pointing his own finger. There was a hollow foo as he squeezed the trigger and the tranquilizer dart blew out of the barrel. A hand reached out of the dune and clawed it down. It was a large brown hand, wavery, made of sand. It simply reached up, in defiance of the wind, and smothered the momentary glitter of the dart. Then the sand fell back with a heavy thrap. No hand. Impossible to believe there had been. But they had all seen it.
"Giddy hump," the captain said in an almost conversational voice.
Excellent Montoya fell on his knees.
"Haiti may for cry, bit gat come, saw ho gat belly gat for cry."
Numbly, Shapiro realized Montoya was saying a rosary in pidgin. Up on the dune, Rand was jumping up and down, shaking his fists at the sky, screeching thinly in triumph. A hand. It was a hand. He's right. It's alive. Alive. Alive.
"Indic,"
the captain said sharply to Montoya.
"Can it? Gat."
Montoya shut up. His eyes touched on the capering figure of Rand and then he looked away. His face was full of superstitious horror, nearly medieval in quality.
"Okay," the captain said. "I've had enough. I quit. We're going."
He shoved two buttons on his dashboard. The motor that should have swiveled him neatly around so he faced up the gangplank again did not hum. It squealed and grated. The captain cursed. The burn shifted again.
"Captain!"
Gomez, in a panic. The captain slammed in another button and the treads began to move backward up the gangplank.
"Guide me," the captain said to Shapiro. "I got no fucking rearview mirror. It was a hand, wasn't it?"
"Yes."
"I want to get out of here," the captain said. "It's been 14 years since I had a cock, but right now I feel like I'm pissing myself."
Thrap!
A dune suddenly collapsed over the gangway. Only it wasn't a dune. It was an arm.
"Fuck! Oh, fuck!"
the captain said. On his dune, Rand capered and screeched. Now the threads of the captain's lower half began to grind. The mini tank of which the captain's head and shoulders were the turret now began to judder backward.
"What?"
The treads locked. Sand splurted out from between them.
"Pick me up!"
the captain bawled to the two remaining androids.
"Now! Right now!"
Their tentacles curled around the tread sprockets as they picked him up. He looked ridiculously like a faculty member about to be tossed in a blanket by a bunch of roughhousing fraternity boys. He was thumbing the communicator.
"Gomez, final firing sequence! Now! Now!"
The dune at the foot of the gangplank shifted, became a hand, a large brown hand that began to scrabble up the incline. Shrieking, Shapiro bolted from that hand. Cursing, the captain was carried away from it. The gangplank was pulled up, the hand fell off and became sand again, the hatchway irised closed, the engines howled. No time for a couch, no time for anything like that. Shapiro dropped into a crash fold position on the bulkhead and was promptly smashed flat by the acceleration. Before unconsciousness washed over him, it seemed he could feel sand grasping at the trader with muscular brown arms, straining to hold them down. Then they were up and away. Rand watched them go. He was sitting down. When the track of the trader's jets was at last gone from the sky, he turned his eyes out to the placid endlessness of the dunes.
"We got a 34 wagon, and we call it a Woody," he croaked to the empty moving sand. "It ain't very cherry. It's an oldie but a goodie."
Slowly, reflectively, he began to cram handful after handful of sand into his mouth. He swallowed, swallowed, swallowed. Soon his belly was a swollen barrel, and sand began to drift over his legs.
The Reaper's Image. Read by David Morse.
We moved it last year, and quite an operation it was, too, Mr. Carlin said as they mounted the stairs. Had to move it by hand, of course. No other way. We insured it against accident with Lloyd's before we even took it out of the case in the drawing room. Only firm that would insure for the sum we had in mind. Spangler said nothing. The man was a fool. Johnson Spangler had learned a long time ago that the only way to talk to a fool was to ignore him. Insured it for $250,000, Mr. Carlin resumed when they reached the second floor landing. His mouth quirked in a half-bitter, half-humorous line. And a pretty penny it cost, too. He was a little man, not quite fat, with rimless glasses and a tan, bald head that shone like a varnished volleyball. A suit of armor, guarding the mahogany shadows of the second-floor corridor, stared at them impassively. It was a long corridor, and Spangler eyed the walls and hangings with a cool, professional eye. Samuel Claggart had bought in copious quantities, but he had not bought well. Like so many of the self-made industry emperors of the late 1800s, he had been little more than a pawn-shop rooter masquerading in collector's clothing, a connoisseur of canvas monstrosities, trashy novels and poetry collections in expensive cowhide bindings, and atrocious pieces of sculpture, all of which he considered art. Up here the walls were hung, festooned was perhaps a better word, with imitation Moroccan drapes, numberless, and no doubt anonymous, Madonnas holding numberless haloed babes, while numberless angels flitted hither and thither in the background, grotesque scrolled candelabra, and one monstrous and obscenely ornate chandelier surmounted by a salaciously grinning nymphet. Of course, the old pirate had come up with a few interesting items. The law of averages demanded it. And if the Samuel Claggart Memorial Private Museum, guided tours on the hour, admission $1 adults, 50 cents children, nauseating, was 98% blatant junk, there was always that other 2%, things like the Coombs rifle over the hearth in the kitchen, that strange little camera obscura in the parlor, and, of course, the Delver looking glass was removed from downstairs after a rather unfortunate incident, Mr. Carlin said abruptly, motivated apparently by a ghastly glaring portrait of no one in particular at the base of the next staircase. There had been others, harsh words, wild statements, but this was an attempt to actually destroy the mirror. The woman, a Miss Sandra Bates, came in with a rock in her pocket. Fortunately, her aim was bad, and she only cracked a corner of the case. The mirror was unharmed. The Bates girl had a brother.
No need to give me the dollar tour, Spangler said quietly. I'm conversant with the history of the Delver glass.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Carlin cast him an odd, oblique look.
There was that English duchess in 1709, and the Pennsylvania rug merchant in 1746, not to mention...
I'm conversant with the history, Spangler repeated quietly. It's the workmanship I'm interested in. And then, of course, there's the question of authenticity.
Authenticity,
Mr. Carlin chuckled. A dry sound, as if bones had stirred in a cupboard below the stairs.
It's been examined by experts, Mr. Spangler.
So was the Lemnier Stradivarius.
So true,
Mr. Carlin said with a sigh.
But no Stradivarius ever had quite the unsettling effect of the Delver glass.
Yes, quite, Spangler said in his softly contemptuous voice. He understood now that there would be no stopping Carlin. He had a mind which was perfectly in tune with the age. Quite. They climbed the third and fourth flights in silence. As they drew closer to the roof of the rambling structure, it became oppressively hot in the dark upper galleries. With the heat came a creeping stench that Spangler knew well, for he had spent all his adult life working in it, a smell of long dead flies in shadowy corners, of wet rot and creeping wood lice behind the plaster, the smell of age. It was a smell common only to museums and mausoleums. He imagined much the same smell might arise from the grave of a virginal young girl, 40 years dead. Up here the relics were piled helter-skelter in true junk-shop profusion. Mr. Carlin led Spangler through a maze of statuary, framed splintered portraits, pompous, gold-plated bird cages, the dismembered skeleton of an ancient tandem bicycle. He led them to the far wall where a stepladder had been set up beneath a trap door in the ceiling. A dusty padlock hung from the trap. Off to the left, an imitation Adonis stared at them piteously with blank, pupilless eyes. One arm was outstretched, and a yellow sign hung on the wrist which read, "Absolutely no admittance." Mr. Carlin produced a key ring from his jacket pocket, selected a key, and mounted the stepladder. He paused on the third rung, his bald head gleaming faintly in the shadows.
"I don't like that mirror," he said. "I never did. I'm afraid to look into it. I'm afraid I might look into it one day and see what the rest of them saw."
"They saw nothing but themselves," Spangler said. Mr. Carlin began to speak, stopped, shook his head, and fumbled above him, craning his neck to fit the key properly into the lock.
"Should be replaced," he muttered. "Damn."
The lock sprung suddenly and swung out of the hasp. Mr. Carlin made a fumbling grab for it and almost fell off the ladder. Spangler caught it deftly and looked up at him. He was clinging shakily to the top of the stepladder, face white in the brown semi-darkness. "You are nervous about it, aren't you?" Spangler said in a mildly wondering tone. Mr. Carlin said nothing. He seemed paralyzed. "Come down," Spangler said, "please, before you fall." Carlin descended the ladder slowly, clinging to each rung like a man tottering over a bottomless chasm. When his feet touched the floor, he began to babble, as if the floor contained some current that had turned him on like an electric light.
"$250,000, he said. $250,000 worth of insurance to take that thing from down there to up here, that goddamn thing. They had to rig a special block and tackle to get it into the gable storeroom up there, and I was hoping, almost praying, that someone's fingers would be slippery, that the rope would be the wrong test, and the thing would fall and be shattered into a million pieces."
"Facts," Spangler said. "Facts, Carlin. Not cheap paperback novels, not cheap tabloid stories, or equally cheap horror movies. Facts. Number one, John Delver was an English craftsman of Norman descent who made mirrors in what we call the Elizabethan period of England's history. He lived and died uneventfully. No pentacles scrawled on the floor for the housekeeper to rub out, no sulfur-smelling documents with a splotch of blood on the dotted line. Number two, his mirrors had become collector's items, due principally to fine craftsmanship, and to the fact that a form of crystal was used that has a mildly magnifying and distorting effect upon the eye of the beholder, a rather distinctive trademark. Number three, only 5 Delvers remain in existence to our present knowledge, 2 of them in America. They are priceless. Number four, this Delver and one other that was destroyed in the London Blitz have gained a rather spurious reputation due largely to falsehood, exaggeration, and coincidence. Fact number 5, Mr. Carlin said, you're a supercilious bastard, aren't you? Spangler looked with mild detestation at the blind-eyed Adonis.
I was guiding the tour that Sandra Bates's brother was a part of when he got his look into your precious Delver mirror, Spangler. He was, perhaps 16, part of a high school group. I was going through the history of the glass, and had just got to the part you would appreciate, extolling the flawless craftsmanship, the perfection of the glass itself, when the boy raised his hand. "But what about that black splotch in the upper left-hand corner?" he asked. "That looks like a mistake." And one of his friends asked him what he meant. So the Bates boy started to tell him, then stopped. He looked at the mirror very closely, pushing right up to the red velvet guard rope around the case. Then he looked behind him, as if what he had seen had been the reflection of someone in black, standing at his shoulder. "It looked like a man," he said, "but I couldn't see the face. It's gone now." And that was all.
"Go on," Spangler said. "You're itching to tell me that it was the Reaper. I believe that is the common explanation, isn't it? That occasional chosen people see the Reaper's image in the glass. Get it out of your system, man. The National Enquirer would love it. Tell me about the horrific consequences and defy me to explain it. Was he later hit by a car? Did he jump out of a window? What?" Mr. Carlin chuckled a forlorn little chuckle. "You should know better, Spangler. Haven't you told me twice that you are, conversant with the history of the Delver Glass? There were no horrific consequences. There never have been. That's why the Delver Glass isn't Sunday supplementized like the Kohinoor Diamond or the curse on King Tut's tomb. It's mundane compared to those. You think I'm a fool, don't you?"
"Yes," Spangler said. "Can we go up now?"
"Certainly," Mr. Carlin said passionately. He climbed the ladder and pushed the trap door. There was a clickety-clackety bump as it was drawn up into the shadows by a counterweight, and then Mr. Carlin disappeared into the shadows. Spangler followed. The blind Adonis stared unknowingly after them. The gable room was explosively hot, lit only by one cobwebby, many-angled window that filtered the hard outside light into a dirty, milky glow. The looking-glass was propped at an angle to the light, catching most of it and reflecting a pearly patch under the far wall. It had been bolted securely into a wooden frame. Mr. Carlin was not looking at it, quite studiously not looking at it.
"You haven't even put a dust cloth over it," Spangler said, visibly angered for the first time.
"I think of it as an eye," Mr. Carlin said. His voice was still drained, perfectly empty. "If it's left open, always open, perhaps it will go blind."
Spangler paid no attention. He took off his jacket, folded the buttons carefully in, and with infinite gentleness he wiped the dust from the convex surface of the glass itself. Then he stood back and looked at it. It was genuine. There was no doubt about it. Never had been, really. It was a perfect example of Delver's particular genius. The cluttered room behind him, his own reflection, Carlin's half-turned figure. They're all clear, sharp, almost three-dimensional. The faint magnifying effect of the glass gave everything a slightly curved effect that added an almost fourth-dimensional distortion. It was... His thought broke off, and he felt another wave of anger.
"Carlin." Carlin said nothing. "Carlin, you damned fool. I thought you said that girl didn't harm the mirror."
No answer. Spangler stared at him icily in the glass.
"There was a piece of friction tape in the upper left-hand corner. Did she crack it? For God's sake, man, speak up." "You're seeing the Reaper," Carlin said. His voice was deadly and without passion. "There is no friction tape on the mirror. Put your hand over it. Dear God."
Spangler wrapped the upper sleeve of his coat carefully around his hand, reached out, and pressed it gently against the mirror.
"You see,
nothing supernatural. It's gone. My hand covers it. Covers it. Can you feel the tape? Why don't you pull it off? Spangler took his hand away carefully and looked into the glass. Everything in it seemed a little more distorted. The room's odd angles seemed to yaw crazily, as if on the verge of sliding off into some unseen eternity. There was no dark spot in the mirror. It was flawless. He felt a sudden unhealthy dread rise in him and despised himself for feeling it. It looked like him, didn't it? Mr. Carlin asked. His face was very pale, and he was looking directly at the floor. A muscle twitched spasmodically in his neck. Admit it, Spangler. It looked like a hooded figure standing behind you, didn't it? It looked like friction tape masking a short crack, Spangler said very firmly. Nothing more, nothing less. The Bates boy was very husky, Carlin said rapidly. His words seemed to drop into the hot, still atmosphere like stones into dark water. Like a football player. He was wearing a lettuce sweater and dark green chinos. We were halfway to the upper half exhibits when the heat is making me feel ill, Spangler said a little unsteadily. He had taken out a handkerchief and was wiping his neck. His eyes searched the convex surface of the mirror in small, jerky movements. When he said he wanted a drink of water, a drink of water, for God's sake. Carlin turned and stared wildly at Spangler. How was I to know? How was I to know? Is there a laboratory? I think I'm going to. His sweater. I just caught a glimpse of his sweater going down the stairs, and then be sick. Carlin shook his head as if to clear it and looked at the floor again. Of course. Third door on your left, second floor, as you go toward the stairs. He looked up, appealingly. How was I to know? But Spangler had already stepped down onto the ladder. It rocked under his weight, and for a moment Carlin thought, hoped, that he would fall. He didn't. Through the open square in the floor, Carlin watched him descend, holding his mouth lightly with one hand. Spangler! But he was gone. Carlin listened to his footfalls fade to echoes, then die away. When they were gone, he shivered violently. He tried to move his own feet to the trapdoor, but they were frozen. Just that last hurried glimpse of the boy's sweater. God! It was as if huge, invisible hands were pulling his head, forcing it up. Not wanting to look, Carlin stared into the glimmering depths of the Delver looking glass. There was nothing there. The room was reflected back to him faithfully, its dusty confines transmuted into glimmering infinity. A snatch of a half-remembered Tennyson poem occurred to him, and he muttered it aloud. I am half sick of shadows, said the Lady of Shalott. And still he could not look away, and the breathing stillness held him. From around one corner of the mirror, a moth-eaten buffalo head peered at him with flat obsidian eyes. The boy had wanted a drink of water, and a fountain was in the first-floor lobby. He had gone downstairs and had never come back. Ever. Anywhere. Like the Duchess who had paused after primping before her glass for a soiree and decided to go back into the sitting room for her pearls. Like the rug merchant who had gone for a carriage ride and had left behind him only an empty carriage and two close-mouthed horses. And the Delver glass had been in New York from 1897 until 1920, had been there when Judge Crater. Carlin stared as if hypnotized into the shallow depths of the mirror. Below, the blind-eyed Adonis kept watch. He waited for Spangler, much like the Bates family must have waited for their son, much like the Duchess's husband must have waited for his wife to return from the sitting room. He stared into the mirror and waited. and waited.
Nona, read by Norbert Leo Butz.
Do you love? I hear her voice saying this. Sometimes I still hear it in my dreams. Do you love? Yes, I answer, yes. And true love will never die. Then I wake up, screaming. I don't know how to explain it, even now. I can't tell you why I did those things. I couldn't do it at the trial either. And there are a lot of people here who ask me about it. There's a psychiatrist who does, but I am silent. My lips are sealed, except here in my cell. Here I am not silent. I wake up screaming. In the dream, I see her walking toward me. She's wearing a white gown, almost transparent, and her expression is one of mingled desire and triumph. She comes to me across a dark room with a stone floor, and I smell dry October roses. Her arms are held open, and I go to her with mine out to enfold her. I feel dread, revulsion, unutterable longing. Dread and revulsion because I know what this place is, longing because I love her. I will always love her. There are times when I wish there was still a death penalty in this state. A short walk down a dim corridor, a straight-backed chair fitted with a steel skull cap, clamps. Then one quick jolt, and I would be with her. As we come together in the dream, my fear grows, but it is impossible for me to draw back from her. My hands press against the smooth plane of her back, her skin near under silk. She smiles with those deep black eyes. Her head tilts up to mine and her lips part, ready to be kissed. That's when she changes, shrivels. Her hair grows coarse and matted, melting from black to an ugly brown that spills down over the creamy whiteness of her cheeks. The eyes shrink and go beady. The whites disappear and she is glaring at me with tiny eyes like two polished pieces of jet. The mouth becomes a maw through which crooked yellow teeth protrude. I try to scream. I try to wake up. I can't. I'm caught again. I'll always be caught. I am in the grip of a huge, noisome graveyard rat. Lights sway in front of my eyes. October roses. Somewhere a dead bell is chanting. Do you love? This thing whispers, do you love? The smell of roses is its breath, and it swoops toward me, dead flowers in a charnel house. Yes, I tell the rat thing. Yes, and true love will never die. Then I do scream, and I am awake. They think what we did together drove me crazy, but my mind is still working in some way or other, and I've never stopped looking for the answers. I still want to know how it was and what it was. They've let me have paper and a pen with a felt tip. I'm going to write everything down. Maybe I'll answer some of their questions, and maybe while I'm doing that, I can answer some of my own. And when I'm done, there's something else. Something they don't know I have. Something I took. It's here, under my mattress. A knife from the prison dining hall. I'll have to start by telling you about Augusta. As I write this, it is night. A fine August night poked through with blazing stars. I can see them through the mesh of my window, which overlooks the exercise yard, and a slice of sky I can block out with two fingers. It's hot, and I'm naked except for my shorts. I can hear the soft summer sound of frogs and crickets, but I can bring back winter.